Welcome to Short Science, your international era-spanning portal for all the very best science in brief. I'm Elizabeth Hawke.
I'm Karine Pikema.
And I'm Thea Cunningham. Today we're going to be looking at sensing and sensors. How do sensors work in the mechanical and chemical worlds? And how is this similar to sensation in our bodies?
Plus, we'll be looking at the phenomenon of synesthesia and hearing from you at home.
And then we'll be answering another listener question from James F. and tackling our mighty quiz. This is Short Science. So, welcome to the show. Now, this is really an exciting one for us because we are trying something entirely new here in the studio. So we actually have three presenters today, myself, Karine and Thea. And given the space constraints of our very tiny studio and our even tinier guest booth, we are really stretching the limits of possibility. And we even have squeezed in two secret guests for you as well. So there's actually five of us in here. I mean, we can't even get the whole presenting team in the same room, so it really is quite ridiculous. But anyway, welcome, Karine and Thea. It's the first time for both of you on the show, so how's it going so far?
It's great. Thank you for having us in this afternoon.
You're quite welcome. How are you, Karine?
I must say, I feel pretty cool with those headphones on.
You look pretty cool too.
Thank
just
you.
Pretend that that's true and it'll all be okay. So now let's get to know our two new guest presenters a little bit. So Thea, let's start with you. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I am yet another SciComm student. I know you've had a few in the previous few weeks. I actually graduated from Cardiff University 2 years ago. I did biochemistry as an undergrad and I'm really enjoying the course so far. It's great fun. Lots of interesting things we've been doing so far. So this is just another fun thing for me to get my teeth into.
Okay, so tell us a bit about your sort of science background. What's your pedigree?
I did biochemistry, so that is actually very, very broad. It covers a lot of things, so I'm really more of a jack of all trades than a specialist in any kind of area. I don't know whether that's a good or a bad thing, really.
I think it's a good thing, but what's your favourite piece of science that you've ever worked on or heard about or learnt?
I'm quite interested in evolution. Evolution always interests me. I like reading about evolution. That's probably my interest.
Interesting stuff. Okay, well, Karine, what about you?
Well, for me, after having been a neuroscientist for 7 years, I decided that it was time for something else. And so I started the master's science media production here. I second what Thea is saying. It's absolutely great.
Okay, so what about, you've done neuroscience, so what sort of things have you particularly worked on?
I was particularly interested in how memory works, so I put people in big magnetic scanners and looked at their brain activity.
Mm-hmm. Interesting stuff. Well, we're going to be hearing more from both Thea and Karine through the show, as they are, in fact, co-presenting with me throughout the entire show. But I did mention that we have some secret guests in our guest booth today. Now, we have Laurie and Adam. Now, they are actually sharing a microphone, which is an incredibly difficult thing to do. It doesn't sound difficult, but believe me, it's really hard. So, hello, Laurie and Adam. Are you there?
Yes, we're here.
Great stuff. Well, tell us a bit about what you're doing at Imperial today and why you've come along to see the radio show.
Well, I'm here today. I'm a noisemaker, which is a science outreach program run by the EPSRC. And we're here today to learn about podcasting and media.
Great stuff. So, have you done anything like this before?
Hi, I'm Adam. Oh, I'm also here with Noise. Personally, no, I haven't done anything even vaguely related to podcasting before. I've been on the radio for about 5 minutes a little while ago, but apart from that, I know practically nothing about it, so it's a bit of a trial by fire.
So the pair of you are sort of spending this day learning about making video podcasts and a little bit about audio podcasts. And you're going to be staying with us for the rest of for a portion of our show to see how we do it here on Short Science, because obviously we're that interesting and important.
That's right.
That we draw the very best from around the world to come and observe us. So I hope you enjoy the show and thank you very much for coming in today. So later in the show, Corinne is going to be telling us all about synesthesia, and that's a pretty complex topic. So we thought we'd introduce this by taking a really simple look at how our senses work and relate this to the functioning of sensors in the material and chemical worlds. But before we get today's show underway, Corinne, tell us about next week's show.
Well, next week, we are going to be talking about space, space flight, space tourism, and good old spaceships. What do you think about space flight? Is it a good idea to go poking around in the universe to see what's out there? Does life exist beyond the bounds of our planet? Will we find alien tribes with advanced societies? Will they be friendly? What do you think about space tourism and the cost, both financial and to the environment?
Wow, so we will be considering all of those things, covering all the bases on space flight next week. So, Thea, now tell us how the good people can get in touch with us and join in our show.
Well, anyone can take part in next week's show, absolutely anyone. So we want your opinion, we want your fact, experience, musings or rantings. You might just have one little thing to say, or you might have lots of gritty points that you want to get across. Either way, we want to hear what you've got to say. So the easiest way to get your voice on air is to call our dedicated recording service on 07401 85681, or if you've recorded your own material, you can email it to studio@shortscience.co.uk.
I just need to just mention that the phone number there, you missed a six out, so it's 07401 85681, just in case anyone was jotting that down as we spoke. But thank you very much for introducing those numbers and our email address. Well, it's time now for the Short Science News in brief. Okay, so Karin, kick us off with your first story.
Earth-sized planets are more common than previously believed. A study published in Science suggests one out of every four stars similar to our Sun have Earth-like planets. New instruments are allowing scientists to look for Earth-like, rocky planets much closer to their home stars. The authors say that studying them will inform us of the way in which planets are formed and will also shed light quite on how many Earth-like planets may exist in our galaxy.
Well, next up today, scientists crack common cold. Researchers think that they may have found a way to beat the common cold. Previously, it was thought that viruses had to be tackled before they entered our cells, making it very hard to treat something like a common cold once it got stuck in. But now they've developed an antibody that actually enters the cell and causes the cell's own garbage disposal unit to set to work on the virus, safely disposing of it. Scientists warn, though, that this major breakthrough still needs years of work before it can be used in practice. Now, Thea, what have you found for us in the news this week?
The 2012 Olympic Games could miss environmental targets. A report published by the London Assembly has warned the 2012 Olympics are on course to fall short of their environmental pledges. The report praised London 2012's aims to limit its carbon footprint, but said its renewable electricity targets and air pollution was of particular concern. Chairman of the Assembly's Environment Committee, Darren Johnson, suggested London's poor air quality could tarnish its international reputation, as well as potentially affecting the health of those attending the Games.
Set limits for salt. Australian researchers are calling for food manufacturers to limit the levels of salt in processed foods. They argue that this simple move could reduce heart disease by 18%. Now, salt causes high blood pressure, which can damage the heart irreversibly, contributing to heart attacks, strokes, and heart failure. Now, the current recommendation is for adults to consume no more than 6 grams of salt per day, and researchers are calling for mandatory labelling of food packaging to help consumers actively monitor their salt intake. So, OK, Karin, back to you. What's your next story?
Fruit flies are finding mates with the help of love bugs. A study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences this week shows that bacteria inside fruit flies influence their mate choice. Researchers at the University of Tel Aviv fed two groups of flies on different foods. When the flies were later put together, females only mated with the males that were from their own breeding group. The researchers showed this preference was the result of a presence of a bacteria from the food. Giving the females an antibiotic made them willing to mate with flies from the other group as well.
Jellyfish used to diagnose cancer. Luminous cells from jellyfish are being used to detect cancers hidden deep in the body. Now, the glowing protein is inserted into viruses that can be programmed to hunt out and pass the glowing protein into cancer cells. They can then be detected using special cameras, revealing the location of the cancer. Professor Norman Mainland hopes that this will help with the early diagnosis of cancer, which is very difficult using current imaging techniques. And finally, for the news today, back to Thea for our last story.
A new infrared camera has been used to study the patterns of six spiral galaxies. Astronomers from the European Organisation for Astronomical Research have used the powerful Hawk 1 camera at the Paranal Observatory in Chile. Unlike previous cameras, Hawk 1 eliminates the confusing effects of dust and gas, making it easier to study the stars that make up the galaxy's spiral arms. The clearer images will help astronomers understand how the spiral patterns in our galaxies form and evolve.
Well, that is it for our news from today, but I've been checking on the archive to see if anything interesting happened on this very day in history. So it turns out that November 3rd has been quite an important day for exploration in years gone by. In 1493, on November 3rd, Christopher Columbus first caught sight of the island of Dominica in the Caribbean. Then, skipping forward a handful of centuries, on this very day in 1957, the first dog undertook space exploration.
A dog?
Yep. Aboard the Russian spaceship Sputnik 2, Laika the dog was the first animal to enter orbit.
Have you got any more interesting items from history?
Well, just one more. On this day in 1973, the Mariner 10 spacecraft was launched by NASA on its way to Mercury. Now, this mission was successful, and eventually, nearly 5 months later, the space probe did arrive on Mercury. So that concludes the news for today. If you have any questions or comments about any of our items, either from 2010 or centuries past, then leave us a message on 07401 856 681 or send an email to studio@shortscience.co.uk. Well, it's time now for this week's Capsule Science. So before we get onto the complex topic of synesthesia, we're going to do a kind of sensors 101. So Thea, take us through the basics. What is a sensor?
A sensor is a type of device that receives and responds to a signal or a stimulus. So that could be heat or pressure or light or motion, etc.
So it detects a sensory input and then it converts that into some kind of output.
Yes, yeah, that's right. So this output might be numerical or it can be differentiated. So a good example of a numerical output is litmus paper. Now, litmus paper is treated with a mixture of 10 or so dyes and then these sense the pH condition and convert it into a numerical value. So, for example, if the solution is acidic, the litmus paper will sense the acidic conditions by turning red, which will tell us it's pH 1 or 2, and so on.
So a sensor is always converting one kind of information into another. So like with the litmus paper, it's converting chemical information into colour, and then we perceive that as light information, and then we convert that kind of intellectually into a numerical value.
Yes, yeah, that's right.
OK, so are there different types of sensors?
Yeah, there are many different types of sensors. Biological, mechanical, chemical, motion sensors. Humans and living organisms possess an incredible amount of natural biological sensors.
OK, so give us an example.
Our eyes, for example, they contain two types of light sensors, the rod cells, now these sense black and white light, and cone cells, which sense bright light and colour. Both of these convert the light into chemical and electrical stimuli, which are then processed by our central nervous systems.
So what about our other senses apart from our eyes?
We've also got skin sensors that detect temperature, pain and itch, and chemical sensors in our nose that give us a sense of smell, and also sensors on our tongue that give us a sense of taste.
OK, so that's kind of human biological sensors. What about mechanical sensors?
Mechanical sensors are much more common than people think. They're everywhere in our everyday lives, if you think about it. In our touch-sensitive phones, computer screens, lamps that dim and brighten when you touch the base, elevator buttons, sensor technology is all around us.
So are a lot of these sensors using computers or computer processing then?
Yes, they are. So often the sensor equipment will be linked to computers. So the sensors will collect the data and then transmit it to the computer or a data logging device. And then this software can then display the data in different formats, such as in graphs or meter readings. So we can see this, for example, in security lights or magnetic devices that are used to sense the opening of a door on a burglar alarm system, or microphones, which have sensors that convert audible sound into an electrical signal, which can then be used to drive speakers.
Okay, so what about using sensors to tell us about the environment around us?
Well, most new cars now have oxygen sensors, which sense the amount of oxygen in the surroundings and feed the data back to the engine computer as part of the emissions control system, if you like. The mechanical sensors are also very common in the environment. So, for example, seismic sensors, which detect earthquakes, sensors on satellites, which can detect radiation from the Earth's atmosphere, and bridges and buildings also have stress sensors built into them.
So sensors really are really important in maintaining our everyday life.
They are incredibly important. In fact, when you think about it, they're everywhere. They're in our bodies, in our homes, in the industry, in classrooms. If we think about a life without sensors, it would be a very hard life indeed.
So is there any limit to how advanced and intelligent sensors can become?
Well, this really remains to be seen. There's definitely research into just how intelligent we can make sensors. Just a few weeks ago, a research team in Madrid presented a new logical DNA sensor. Now, this sensor is actually built with DNA and follows if-then rules. So, for example, if symptoms 1 and 2 are present, then disease A is present, and so on. So the sensor can essentially detect a set of symptoms and output a genetic diagnosis and maybe even administer the correct drug.
Well, there seems to be absolutely no end to what we can detect, but some things that we might want to know about are really remote or inaccessible. So how will science help us to deploy sensors to these areas?
Well, scientists are also getting kind of more imaginative with how they can use sensors. Oceanographers have recently attached temperature sensors to toothed whales in a bay up near West Greenland, so they can actually detect the ocean temperature. And because winters that far north are extremely kind of inhospitable, it makes it hard for researchers to actually access the bay to do their own research. So they've attached these sensors to the whales, and that's been really useful for filling in gaps in climate records, and they've actually shown that the cold water beneath the pack ice is actually getting warmer, which is obviously very significant evidence in terms of climate change.
Well, this seems to be some really exciting things happening in the world of sensors at the moment, and also the applications of sensors. So thanks ever so much for telling us about sensors, Thea. Now let's crack on with this week's Capsule Medicine. Right, so we've covered sensors and sensing. So now let's look at what happens when our senses overlap in a phenomenon called synesthesia. So Karin, what is synesthesia?
Synesthesia, syn meaning together and aesthesis meaning sensation, is a neurological condition in which particular sensation causes involuntary co-occurrence of a different modality of sensation. This can happen between any of the senses. For instance, the days of the week may have their own particular colours, G major may have a particular smell, and a triangle a specific taste.
Okay, well, that all sounds rather abstract. Can you give us like an example or an impression as to what it's like to have synesthesia?
Well, I don't have synesthesia myself, so I don't personally know what it would be like. But I can read you a quote from the daughter of famous neuroscientist Oliver Sacks, who has synesthesia. She says, "The letter P is a very deep black with purple undertone. It's blotchy and sometimes feels like a stuffy nose. It's male." Does that give you some idea?
A little bit, but how do we know that people just aren't making it up?
Well, there is an extraordinary consistency and stability over time in these associations. So Oliver Sacks' daughter will probably always think SP, of the letter P as male, and D black with purple undertones. Synesthetes can also be helped or hampered by their particular associations. For instance, psychologists devised a tricky task where you have to search a picture containing lots of number fives to see if it also contains a number two. Give this task to a synesthete who sees numbers as having a particular colour, and they will be able to solve it in seconds, as twos, the colour of two, will actually just pop out against the number five's background colour. And another funny thing is that there is no general pattern. A Monday may be green to one synesthete, but pink for another.
So it sounds like if you had two synesthetes in a room together, they could have some quite interesting arguments.
Yes, indeed. Here's another quote from one of Oliver Sacks' readers to give you an idea how passionately synesthetes can be about their own sensations. I have been reading your book, i.e. Oliver Sacks's, Musicophilia, and have just started on the chapter of synesthesia, but could read no further than the third page because the person you cite defines D major as blue. I couldn't believe my reaction for a person not feeling the same colour as I do for D, which is vermilion red. It actually made me feel slightly dizzy and nauseous.
So that's quite a strong feeling for something that many of us don't even quite understand. But consistency surely is not definitive proof that the associations aren't just made up or imagined.
No, that's true. There are some physiological differences. All of us are born with many more communication pathways than we end up with, and these are pruned back over the first years of our lives. However, in synesthetes, it appears that perhaps not all these pathways disappear. This may lead to an unintended crossover of signals from one brain region to the other. In fact, during brain scans of synesthetes, we can see activity not only in brain regions that normally process particular information, for instance, the auditory cortex when we are listening to a song, but also the associated synesthetic brain region, for example, visual cortex, if the synesthete sees colours with sounds.
Okay, so are genetics involved in whether or not you become a synesthete?
Yes, although we don't know exactly which specific genes, synesthesia does seem to run in the family. In 50% of synesthesia cases, a first-degree relative has synesthesia too. There is a famous anecdote of the Russian novelist Vladimir Nabokov, who was given a coloured alphabet set on his 8th birthday. He was terribly disappointed. "The colours are all wrong," he exclaimed. While his father had apparently looked at him as if he was speaking in a different language, his mother said to have nodded in agreement.
So for a neurological disorder, though, it doesn't sound so bad. In fact, if there are a way in which other people could experience music in colours or taste the shape of a square, I'm sure they would be quite tempted to try it.
I know what you mean. We should probably see it more as a neurological difference than a disorder. Actually, probably about 1 in 20 of us have synesthesia. Scientists can't be exactly precise on this number because it is such a harmless disorder, and most people only find out that they have it by accident. And even if you have some mild form of synesthesia, imagine that even you and I have some mild forms of synesthesia. Imagine that I have two cartoon shapes. One is spiky, like a star, and the other is rounded, a bit more like a cloud. The names are Booba and Kiki. Which one do you think is Booba and which Kiki?
Well, Kiki must be the sharp shape, whereas Booba must be the cloud-like roundy one, right?
Exactly right. And this is what over 95% of respondents generally say. Yeah, there is no real reason why they should feel like that to us. So there must be some crossover of the senses taking place here as well. Anyway, you can explore your own synesthetic tendencies by taking an online test at synesthesia.feinheit, that's feinheit.ch/en.
Great stuff. Now, we will put that web link up on our website if you want to have a go and find out about your own synesthetic tendencies. So if you have any questions about anything we've been talking about today, or you'd like to send in your comments or thoughts, you can leave a message on our recording service at 07401 856681 or send an email to studio@shortscience.co.uk. So let's have a check of our recording service and email inbox and see what you listening at home have had to say this week.
You've got mail.
Yes, we have indeed had some people send things in. So we asked you at home, what do you think about synesthesia? So let's see who's sent in their experiences. Yes, so Paola Ferracca, our Italian correspondent, was here in the studio last week, but this week has been out and about trying to find someone with a synesthetic tendency. Okay, we're having a moment of iPod dysfunction here. Let me just get that going for you. Here we go.
Paola Ferracca, reporting for Sure Science. This week we speak about synesthesia, so I went around and asked to some friend of mine to see what they think about it. Let's listen. Have you ever experienced synesthesia?
No, it's not something that I would, that I've thought about, that I have actually sort of associated colours or numbers with things. But I do think when I'm out in the outdoors, thinking of water, I associate descriptive words with things like in the woods, with leaves, the rustling of leaves, the noises that can in the surroundings, or water, the sounds of the water in the outdoors with the cliffs, if I'm walking out in the outdoors. But it's not something I can think about that I've come across.
Have you ever experienced synesthesia?
I actually have. Since I was 3 years old, I've been associating like numbers and, what do you say, and personalities. For example, 7 is the coolest guy and 8 is fat, the fat bit, you know, shy guy, and 5 is nice, very kind. All of them are male, actually. No, number 2 is female, and she's a bit like plain and boring.
This is Sol, Paola Ferracca, reporting for Sure Science.
So thanks ever so much to Paola for sending that in. Now, Paola's found one person who imagines what synesthesia is like and probably has a very, very tiny bit of it, and then one person there who sounds like they do have a certain degree of synesthesia. I always think it's one of those really funny things. It's sort of a spectrum because it's so close to imagination. Like, I could imagine that colours have certain numbers associated with them, or numbers have certain colours associated with them, but is it actually real, and am I just imagining it? And then somebody who has synesthesia would say that, no, it's a fact, it's always like that. But what do you think, Karine?
Sorry, I zoned out a bit. Can you...
Yeah, so we were just saying that it's a sort of a spectrum between what, from people who sort of imagine associations to people who experience solid associations that are consistent throughout their life. And you can sort of lie anywhere on that spectrum, really.
Yes, you can. So there are quite a lot of the associations the lady in the clip talks about are really sort of the more cultural associations we have.
Yeah.
And the synesthetic ones are more actually sort of, they don't really have anything to do with culture. They're just very spontaneous activities.
Okay, well, let's have a listen now to what another listener has sent in about their experience.
Hello, my name's Chris, and ever since I can remember, I have associated colours with numbers and with days of the week. For instance, number 5 is a definite yellow, number 6 is a definite red, number 7 is a definite green, number 3 is a brighter blue, 4 is more muddy and more mushroom-like, and 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 and 10 are vaguer. Again, more muddy and grey-like. 9 is definitely blacker, as is 1, strangely. Same with days of the week. Monday is a darkish blue. Sunday is a very much bright blue. Saturday, like yellow. Saturday, like the number 5, is very yellow. Friday is absolutely bright red, like 6. Wednesday is green, very similar to the green of 7, but maybe a bit brighter. Thursday, again, is that muddy, mushroomy colour. What have we got left? Tuesday, that's a lighter, beigier, muddy colour. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. That's it.
Great stuff. So thanks very much to Chris for sending that in. So it sounds like he has the more classical form of synesthesia, where he has a definite colour association with a particular number and day of the week.
Exactly. Now that I haven't zoned out, I follow what he was saying, and it is the classical example of what synesthesia is.
So now we've had this question in from Monique. Now, she has asked, for people with lexical gustatory synesthesia, so this is a term that matches particular words with tastes, what she would like to know is, would the same word said in different languages invoke the same taste sensations? And if so, would the foreign word-induced synesthesia only emerge after the synesthete learns the meaning of the foreign word? Now, I couldn't find anybody that had lexical gustatory synesthesia where there was a taste and word association, but I did get back in touch with Chris and ask him about colours and days of the week. So I actually tested him and I asked him, I said the days of the week in a number of different languages that I knew he didn't know, and then some languages that he did know. Now, in the languages that he didn't know, what happened was he got a colour sensation in his mind that wasn't associated with the correct day of the week, but was associated with the way the word sounded. So, for example, giovedì, Thursday in Italian, said very badly, his colour association was to do with the letter G, not with the word giovedì or Thursday. But then when I told him it meant Thursday, he then thought about it, we said the word in a sentence, and he saw a combination of the colours for the letter G and the colour for the meaning Thursday. And the more times we said it and the more times he knew the meaning, the word meaning got stronger, and then the colours associated with the letters of the word got slightly dimmer.
So there's a kind of crossover.
Merged. And then when we said words in a foreign language that he knew the meaning of, so he knows French, so we then said, okay, what about jeudi, Thursday in French? And he then said, no, that's the colour for Thursday, because he knows it's Thursday. And that he doesn't worry about the shape of the word, and he doesn't hear the shape of the word, he just sees the meaning. So that was quite interesting.
Is that limited to what foreign languages he can speak?
It was limited to my ability to look up those different languages.
Yeah, I think if you know the meaning of the word, then that's probably a stronger, that causes a stronger response. Than the sound maybe. But I to be honest, I don't really know. And this is exactly why I zoned out, because I was reading the question and was really worried and I wouldn't get an answer.
Well, there you go. See, I did some real word research. Got the answer. Now, we must answer, we must draw a line under synesthesia now and answer the question that's come in from our listener, James F. So he wanted to know what happens inside a computer when you press on the send button in an email.
Yeah, what does happen?
Okay, so James, imagine you've just written an email to Short Science. Now, the first thing that your computer does when you press send is to divide up your message into two parts.
Two parts?
Yes, so now the first part is called the header, and that contains all the address and sender information. So we'll have Short Science's email address and your email address, James. And it's really a bit like an envelope on a conventional letter. So it has all the information that allows it to be routed to a server.
I'm just going to interrupt you there. What exactly is a server?
Okay, so a server is just like a really big computer with a massive memory that stores information on the internet. So James's email will go up to a server, and the address information in the header or in the envelope of that letter makes sure that the email is sent to the server that stores information for Short Science's email service. So lots of people have emails that are with Yahoo or Gmail or Hotmail, and they all have different servers. So it will go to the one that deals with our email. Now, when we then log onto our email in the office, our computer contacts that server and downloads James's message.
So it kind of recognises that the message has been downloaded. So if the envelope-like header was the first part of the email, then what's the second part?
So the second part that it packages up is the message itself, and that is just like the letter in the envelope.
So, like the letter in the envelope, you post it in a letterbox, but how does our email get onto the server?
Yeah, well, obviously you can't, if you just printed the email out and posted it in the letterbox, it would in fact be a letter. So there has to be some clever electrical way that it does it. And when James presses send, the computer converts all the typed information in the email into coded information called data. Now, data is then converted into an electromagnetic signal, which can then be sent along the internet cable via the phone lines or cable lines into the World Wide Web, eventually reaching the right server. And I say eventually, but it actually happens in seconds, so it's really, really quick.
So that's essentially all there is to it, is that?
Pretty much, yes. So I hope that's answered your question, James. So we don't... Don't forget that anyone can send in a question to be answered on the show. Just email studio@shortscience.co.uk or call in with your question to +44 7401 856 681. Now we're going to move straight into our quiz, and we're going to have to be super quick and do just one question each today, as we are running incredibly late because we had so many fantastically interesting things to say. So I'm going to go first to Corinne. Corinne, choose your best question.
Okay, I'll take this one. There are quite a few famous people who have had synesthesia. Can you pick the synesthete out of this list? So we first have the painter Vasily Kandinsky, then the novelist Vladimir Nabokov, and the physicist Richard Feynman. So which do you think
it
is?
Okay, so Thea, you guess first. What do you reckon?
Oh, I don't know. What do you think?
I think I know the answer, because Corinne has gone for the sensible but somewhat easy approach of doing memory questions. So she said the answers already in her capsule, and I was listening.
I'm going to say so I think Vasily I know. Vasily Kandinsky. I'm going to go for A.
I'm going to go for Vladimir Nabokov.
They're both very, very similar sounding V names there, so there is room for error.
Well, in fact, you are all right, because all of them...
A trick question. I like.
But you see, she's being kind to us.
I have this thing where I have to win on the show. So,
well, you've got one point
so
there.
You've done a question where I couldn't have lost, which is just, I like that. That's very good. Okay, so Thea, your question.
Yes, my question today. True or false? The singer Stevie Wonder suffers from anosmia, which is no sense of smell.
Oh, I don't know. I know he's blind.
Yeah, and...
maybe crossover of the sentence means that he's got an extra good smell.
It could be. Or if you think about the causes of blindness, the optic nerves and everything, they go very, very close to the olfactory tract, which is the nerves that serve the nose and deal with smell. So if he had some cause of blindness that was structural, that could have interrupted his sense of smell as well.
So are you going to go for true or false?
So I'm going to go for true.
Then I have to go for false.
Okay.
Well, the actual answer is true. He does have anosmia. As well as being blind, he actually doesn't have a sense of smell. So Elizabeth has another score on that one.
May have been dubious reasoning.
You can't lose anymore.
Okay, so we have run so long today. We've got to call time for today. So don't forget to call in to +44 7401 856 681 with your thoughts on space travel for next week's show. And also keep your plant-related questions coming in for horticulturalist Austin Zingle, who will be on hand in the coming weeks to answer them for you.
Or email any questions, musings, links to material, or to the studio here at studio@shortscience.co.uk.
And you can also check out our website for all the details about how to get in touch. So that's www.shortscience.co.uk. So thank you very much for listening. This has been Short Science. Thanks to our contributors, Paola Faraca and Chris. Thanks also to James F. for his great question. The presenters today were Karin Pickamer, Thea Cunningham and myself, Elizabeth Hawke. We took care of our own production here in the studio, and the theme tune was written and produced by Don Gould of Music by Design.
Thanks very much for listening, and join us next week for another episode of Short Science.
Radiofonica.com. Va bene, invece non va, e se migliora allora peggiorerà, pure sono sicuro che fa male, arrivo di là, te lo dico, tu mi dici ma va, e ancora a me succede che va bene e invece non va, se migliora allora peggiorerà, oppure sono sicuro che va male, arrivo di là, e te lo dico, tu mi dici ti va, ma io così non vado avanti.
Mi ricordi il male, non per i riflessi, per il sugo andato a male, il qualunquismo dei discorsi sotto l'ombrellone, sudoku che non torna è quello che era scritto appena, è già da cancellare, è come l'amore, va di tasca in tasca come l'accendino vuole, ti ritorna quando non hai niente da picciare, se escludiamo il poco che rimane, ancora, ancora. Ancora.
Baci, baci ed abbracci che diventano lacci, più diventano stretti, più nascondono in bici, come un cane ti accucci sui tuoi poveri stracci, piano piano vai giù, come un programma di soggi, piano piano vai giù, ma poco dopo risorgi, solo che non ti accorgi dei sorrisi posticci, dei pensieri che scacci, delle cose che lasci per banali capricci.
Guardi il mare, non per gli ombrelloni, per la fila in tangenziale, il malfunzionamento del mio condizionatore, la discesa libera sui sassi senza aver le scarpe, per fare i fricchettoni, questo è un po' il sapore, del tutto compreso, inclusa la consumazione, io l'ho già bevuta e pure ho ancora troppa sete, soprattutto quando tu mi uccidi, ancora, ancora.
Quello di chi si trattiene a merco di mare, e non per le vacanze che abbiamo fatto insieme, tra il gesto di chi offre, quello di chi si tratta,
mi ricordi il mare, non per gli ombrelloni, per la fila in tangenziale, il malfunzionamento del mio condizionatore, la discesa libera sui sassi senza delle scarpe, per fare i fricchettoni, mi ricordi il mare, per il sugo andato a mano, il qualunquismo dei discorsi sotto l'ombrellone, il sudoku che non torna è quello che era scritto appena, è già da cancellare.
Questa mattina, che è successo?
Eh già, prima di uscire di casa ho ascoltato Radio Visioni, il programma sul cinema, tutto da ascoltare.
Ah sì, su www.radiofonica.com, la web radio con molti programmi di spessore culturale, tra l'altro.
Ma sì, c'è pure Universo Parallelo, un nuovo programma, tutto di cultura.
Radiofonica.com.
closer.
Radiofonica.com.